sometimes with the rights of nature being a legal framework, so you know, which requires working within the establishment, right? Mm-hmm. But like you said, it does very much make sense. I mean, just because I hate bureaucracy and I don't like the status quo in the establishment and I don't like working within the system, that doesn't make it go away. And mm-hmm. it is, you know, that system, the power structures inside of that system have to be dismantled. They have to be turned upside down. And that's mm-hmm. what rights of nature is. It means fundamentally shifting power. And it means in the fundamental structures of our law, acknowledging our dependence on nature, respecting nature and the need to live in harmony with her.
Hey everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. In this episode, I speak with Melissa Troutman and Joshua Prabanik. They are the co-directors of the documentary film Invisible Hand. They're also the editors, producers, and writers of this film. And this film was also executive produced by award-winning actor Mark Ruffalo, who is also one of the narrators of the film. And to give just a bit of background before I give my take on the film, because I did watch it, which I'm very grateful for, I'm going to just read this short synopsis of the film on their website. I think this will do a really good job of giving a really basic understanding of what the focus of this film is. Produced by award-winning actor Mark Ruffalo, Invisible Hand takes you behind the curtain of the global economy where rights of nature becomes capitalism's one true opponent. In the fall of 2014, for the first time in United States history, an ecosystem filed to defend itself in a lawsuit claiming its right to exist in Grant Township, Pennsylvania. For attempting such a radical act, Grant's rural community of 700 people were sued by a corporation, then by the state government, and are now locked in a battle to defend the watershed they call home through civil disobedience. The water they drink, the rights of nature laws they've passed, are all on the line in this exclusive story. In Toledo, Ohio, an earth-shattering vote was passed to enact the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, granting personhood to international waters. Half a continent away in Standing Rock, North Dakota, the same industry threatening Grant Township is using militarized force against indigenous tribes and allies fighting to protect Mother Earth. Activists leaving Standing Rock are rejoined on the Pennsylvania and New York border, where the Seneca Nation of Indians aligns with communities in the Triple Divide to stop radioactive fracking waste from entering Ohio waters. Terry Pagula, owner of Buffalo Bills and Sabres, threatens to sue Invisible Hand filmmakers and whoever continues to speak out about his oil and gas company and their efforts. The four Grant Township, Lake Erie Bill of Rights, Defend Ohio, and Standing Rock are joined in an international fight to protect more than just water. They fight for their community, democracy, and for nature as a living entity unto itself. In the end, who will speak for nature? As I mentioned there in reading that, the rights of nature movement is really the focus of this film, and it's what we lay out in this interview with Melissa and Joshua. This film, and I say this during the interview, maybe at least once or twice, I'll just state it again. This film is really, really beautiful, not just for the content, like what they're actually addressing and the movements that they document, the various communities around the United States in particular. And I just want to also say that this is an international movement. We've been seeing the rights of nature movement in other parts of the world, whether I think some of the places that are referenced is Ecuador, as well as Bolivia. And I think New Zealand was another place where they've put in certain protections for certain ecosystems and other natural systems. So this is international in scope, but in the United States in particular, we have the fossil fuel industry, the fracking industry in particular, industrial agricultural projects and corporations that are polluting watersheds, aquifers, rivers, lakes, and so on. And so there are, you know, numerous communities around the United States that are on the front lines of this, and they've done everything they can within the legal framework to push back against corporations. Now, this is also worth noting that corporations under U.S. law are considered people. They're considered persons. they have pretty much the same rights as an individual like myself would have under the Constitution. This has allowed corporations with just enormous amounts of resources at their disposal to just push through really environmentally destructive practices in alignment with such regulatory agencies as the EPA. That's another aspect of this film, which is really important to understand. And what was also addressed in this interview is that the regulatory agencies that we assume are there to protect communities from environmental pollution, destruction, etc., actually don't really work in the favor of the people, of nature, of communities. They actually just put their stamp of approval on a lot of these environmentally destructive practices by basically saying, oh, you know, we're regulating the toxification of your environment, the pollution of your environment, instead of actually just stopping it from happening altogether. And so, yeah, I mean, this documentary is just addressing one of the many, I would say one of several tools that communities and environmental activists and so on are using to, again, protect the environment, to protect other living entities, ecosystems, and using a legal framework in order to push back against the destruction of these living entities, which, of course, we are all inextricably tied up with and connected to. That separation between human life and other forms of life on this planet and other systems of life on this planet. I mean, there really is no actual separation or difference between the two. When you pollute the land, the water, when you cause massive destruction on a local and on a much larger scale as well, you know, you're basically killing off human life in that process. You're making it incredibly difficult for us to live and thrive as organisms on this planet when your rivers and lakes are being polluted with very little consequence. So this rights of nature movement of creating a bill of rights for ecosystems and other natural entities is just one of several tools at activists and communities' disposal to address these crimes that are being committed against nature. It's a really great discussion with both of these individuals. They're just, they've been covering this story for years, and this film, I can just tell how much attention to detail and love was put into producing this film. It's incredibly moving to watch these communities push back against these capitalist enterprises, these giant corporations that have very little, if no concern at all, for the health and well-being of these communities, of the natural world, and so on. So this is just one tool in the toolbox. And I think I want to make that a little clear, because something we kind of address in this a little bit is how there's this sort of natural almost resistance to engaging with the legal system, because something that is also understood by many of these communities as they start to really do this difficult work of pushing back against environmental destruction in their communities is that the legal structure in the United States especially, but I imagine this is the case in so many other countries around the world, is not designed to really benefit the natural world or communities. And so it's, again, there are these paths that they have forged to address this issue through the legal system. But again, I just need to reiterate this point, which is that this is just one of several tactics that can be used to fight the destruction of the natural world. And this film does an excellent job of showing that. And I think also what's important here is that, you know, this film most definitely includes and centers around the indigenous perspective. As I mentioned in reading that synopsis, they talk about Standing Rock, of course. They show the Standing Rock water protectors in that encampment in North Dakota, and also the Seneca Nation. You know, again, these are indigenous communities, these are indigenous peoples that are almost always, in the case of environmental activism, they are always on the front line of protecting water, of protecting the land, of protecting these natural systems that we all rely upon for our own well-being and our own survival. And so really the rights of nature movement is trying to basically put that indigenous perspective, that indigenous way of understanding the world and our relationship to it within the legal system, Whether that is fully effective in every circumstance or every situation is really, I mean, it's all contextual. But under certain circumstances, it actually does create a really positive change in effect and actually can be used to push back against these exploitive corporations. So I just want to make that note because I understand that there's a hesitancy on my part and I think on the part of so many others of accepting that maybe working with the legal system may produce positive outcomes. I'm only here to say that yes, it is possible. There are avenues forward with that, but that is not the only thing that is available to us in regards to resistance. I would ask if you all want to learn more about Invisible Hand, you can go to the website invisiblehandfilm.com. You'll learn everything you need to know about how you can watch this film. And if you would like to also support what Joshua and Melissa are doing as far as, because they have future projects that they may be working on, and just to support the production and release of this film, you can do that through their Public Herald Patreon page. I will put a link to their Patreon page, which is patreon.com/publicherald, down in the description. And if you would like to support my work specifically, there's a couple ways to do that. The first, of course, is through just a one-time donation, through PayPal, and also Venmo. I have that set up as well. So you can go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, make a donation through that, or through my Venmo, which is at lastbornpodcast. You can find me there. And if you'd like to support this work on a regular monthly basis, you can do that through Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/lastbornin the wilderness. And by contributing there on a monthly basis, you'll gain early access to these interviews before they're publicly released and some other exclusive content there as well. And if you'd like to learn more about this podcast and this project, you can go to my website, lastbornin the wilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. So I just really want to thank Melissa and Joshua for taking the time to have this discussion with me. And I really thank them for letting me see their film. And I would really ask that people please go check out this film. It's very good and well worth your time. All right, without any further delay, here is my interview with Melissa Troutman and Joshua Pribanek. All right, well, thank you both, Josh and Melissa, for joining me for this episode, for this interview. And thank you for letting me watch your film, Invisible Hand. I, as I mentioned before we started, I watched it a couple times. I watched it again last night. And I just have to just compliment you both for just how excellent it is. It's like the subject matter is really important, but just the cinematography, the music, just the way the whole film progresses, the people you document, the communities you document in this film are just really, it was really moving to watch. And it's something that I don't think a lot of people are really aware of as much. You know, it's like a kind of a, I wouldn't say it's an underground movement at all, but it's something that, and I was sharing this film, or not the film, but like telling some people about it, and they had no idea what the, rights of nature movement is and how that even works. I was talking to my mom last night about it, and I'm like, yeah, like they want to give, like communities want to give like lakes and rivers and other things like actual rights legally. She's like, I don't understand that concept. And I'm like, I guess I've been more familiar with this idea on some level for a while now, but just sort of presenting it to the average person is still a little new. But once you kind of lay it out, it makes a lot of sense. And anyway, I think your film is excellent, and I'm just so happy that I had the chance to watch it. So thank you both for your work.
Well, thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick.
Yeah. Well, and I just want to...
Sorry.
Go on. No, you're good.
Thank you for your work, too. I'm really, you know, we're really glad to be a part of Last Born in the Wilderness podcast because, and this is it's a perfect platform to talk about rights of nature because your podcast is all about these really, really deep, deep conversations about, I mean, you're so good at getting down to the core issues underpinning all of our struggles. And that's where the rights of nature comes into play. So
yeah,
thank you too.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah. I'm just glad like doing this work, I've been able to connect with some pretty incredible human beings. And that's probably the most gratifying thing about about doing this. It's meeting people like you, like both of you. Yeah.
Yeah, disclaimer, I'm now a last born in the wilderness patron, so
yeah, I saw that. I saw that. I was gonna say it maybe off the record, but thank you so much, by the way. Yeah. You did the yearly subscription thing, like that's an option Patreon now has where you can like just throw money at a creator or whatever for like a year's worth, which is a pretty cool option. But
yeah, you deserve it. Melissa said, you know, it's really important that people are having genuine conversations in regards to what's happening in our society and what's happening with our ecosystems. Especially on the terms of these anthropocentric models that we all live under. And, you know, it's refreshing to get more content like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I just feel lucky and blessed to be able to connect with so many incredible people and that have these perspectives and are working very hard to present ideas like, you know, rights of nature to a broader public, you know, just sort of like, hey, this actually makes sense. We should embrace this idea. And it's, you know, something that I when I was watching the film, and I have to admit, like, I'm resistant to almost this idea of like, why would you ever want to work with the legal system at all? Like, I have this such an aversion to bureaucracy and like the legal system, but like, I totally understand if you're in a community and they want to put an injection site or a fracking operation or some other just horribly environmentally or ecologically destructive project near where people live and affecting their ability to just have a healthy life. I mean, it's like you'll do whatever you have to do to stop these giant corporations, these energy companies from getting away with murder, basically. I mean, that's essentially what it is. And yeah, I mean, and that was, again, the most moving thing is just watching these communities just go through that process, years and years and years of work, just to be like, look, we don't want our water poisoned. It's so simple. And yeah, I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. We haven't even really talked about the film proper yet, but I just I just say that film has just left such an impression on me. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you're conversation, you know, with your mother is a common situation for everybody. You know, I know Mark Ruffalo, who's an executive producer on the film, you know, when he had to have this conversation as well with people close to him, you know, they were also taken aback, like, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean, you know, I can't do certain things? And what does that really mean? And I think we've been trying to frame it, you know, under the structure of things like freedom of biodiversity. You know, trying to create that kind of ideological structure and commitment and belief in society. And that means things like adopting ecocide laws. You know, that's where you can see the legal system actually working for rights of nature and why it would be necessary under rights of nature, because you don't want to be in a situation where products are produced or people annihilate ecosystems and there's not a law to hold them accountable, which there isn't right now. You know, they can just pay a fine and walk away. Yeah. And I think, you know, rights of nature is introducing these really paradigm shifting concepts like ecocide. And those are, for me, like so critical as we move forward on the discussion about the climate crisis and everything else.
Yeah.
I still struggle with sometimes with the rights of nature being a legal framework. So you know, which requires working within the establishment, right? But like you said, it does very much make sense. I mean, just because I hate bureaucracy and I don't like the status quo in the establishment and I don't like working within the system, that doesn't make it go away. And it is, you know, that system, the power structures inside of that system have to be dismantled. They have to be turned upside down. And that's what rights of nature is. It means fundamentally shifting power. And it means in the fundamental structures of our law, acknowledging our dependence on nature, respecting nature and the need to live in harmony with her. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, securing the highest legal protection for nature and for the rights of nature and the associated human rights that are enveloped mm-hmm. in that.
Yeah. Well, I just look at it like it's a multi, we can have a multifaceted or multi-pronged approach when it comes to resistance, you know? Mm. If this works, then we should use it. And if, you know, if it means working with the legal system in some way to make, you know, certain paths forward possible in regards to stopping ecocide, then we should take those, you know, we should reuse those resources and those tools at our disposal. And I just appreciate, again, how that was addressed in the film. Let me just ask you this. I mean, something that's just a very simple question, but how long have you both worked on this film? It seems like it was filmed over years, because you have footage from, like, Standing Rock back in 2016.
For sure.
I don't know if that was both of you there or what was going on exactly, but it just seems like this film has been in the works for some time. So how long have you been working on this project?
Yeah, it was both of us there. You know, Melissa and I were there filming together, and it was a magical experience, which is why in the film, when you see that section, we show as much of the beauty of that place as we could, just because of what they created was just this, you know, amazing symbiotic effort to try and stop that pipeline. And the harmony in the camp was profound. You know, mm-hmm. you had that, and then you had this shadow of police brutality right at the border of it. But that was shot in 2016, but Melissa and I really started filming seriously in 2014 with discussions about making the film in 2013 after we released our first documentary, Triple Divide, and people were asking, you know, what are we supposed to do? And Melissa and I were like, well, there's a lot of options out there, mm-hmm. and we would really like to kind of narrow down what's the most powerful one, and that's what became Invisible Hand, which was a film trying to answer the question, you know, who speaks for nature? So it was 2014 that we started, and then we finished in September of this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Well, let me ask about this. I mean, the name Invisible Hand, I mean, I once I watched the film, I understood where the name came from, but... Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting name. Where does the name come from? Maybe I'll ask Melissa where the name comes from.
So the invisible hand is a theory, an economic theory, capitalist theory, that in the pursuit for individual self-interest in the free market, so-called, there is an invisible hand that keeps everything in balance so that that pursuit of self-interest doesn't harm others. Mm-hmm. And that is, of course, not what happens. And we, you know, Josh and I were conceptualizing the film. He said, you know, it's really nature. It's not a human hand that's keeping anything in balance. It's nature that is the checks and the system of checks and balances on our economy, on our society. I mean, and that evidence has always been everywhere, but in the age of climate catastrophe is clearer and clearer all the time. Mm-hmm. With water scarcity, of course, being one of the most obvious. Farmers can't farm without copious amounts of water. They're starting to have to cut back production on big monoculture farms. They're having to change farming practices. And, you know, those are economic changes too. So that's where, that's where it comes from.
Yeah. You're referencing Milton Friedman.
We don't explicitly say it in the film, but we're challenging that theory because that theory is being taught in colleges right now and everywhere else, as if there's this existing structure out there, this invisible hand, which is balancing that marketplace based on, you know, your pursuit of profit or something like that. And the fact is that as the climate crisis grows, as the ecocide problem grows. And as Melissa said, farmers don't have enough water to grow their crops. They're having to change their economic interest and their self-interest in order to cooperate and use nature's resources in order to produce a product on the market. And that's an invisible hand that's controlled by nature. That's not one that's controlled by man. So I think that, time will tell if that theory gets rewritten and gets changed, but that's definitely a subtext in the film that we're going after.
Yeah. Well, I was watching the film and they show these segments of Milton Friedman talking about the invisible hand of the market, the free market, which he was a big proponent of. I couldn't stop thinking about a friend I had years ago who was this big capitalist, pro-capitalist guy. And he was basically saying I think he was just parroting Friedman's ideas there, but he was talking about economics. Free market economics is like this hard science. Like he was treating it like it was like physics or something, which, you know what I mean? Like if the state just gets out of all interfering in the market, if you just let it be, it'll work out perfectly. It's like this perfectly functioning system. And I remember at the time I couldn't really articulate it or explain why I felt that was so messed up and not correct.
Yeah. Well, it is a perfectly functioning system if your goal is racism and resource extraction. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Ideal
system there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if you read Friedman's books, you know, if you read Free to Choose and Capitalism and Freedom and stuff, you look at them with a critical eye rather than adoration, you know, you can see right away that these are utopian doctrines. They're not realistic at all, and they're certainly not scientific.
Yeah, and it does excludes the natural world in that framework, and like the needs of the natural world, and how we are organisms on this planet that need certain things like clean water and, you know, a healthy environment to live and thrive in. I mean, and when we think about rights, about granting rights within a liberal democracy framework, which we have to a certain degree, you know, it's been so normalized, we don't think about it, but human beings have individual rights. We also know that corporations have been granted those rights. They're legally considered persons under the law. But we don't think about ecosystems having their own rights, like lakes, rivers, mountains, etc. We don't extend it to them. I think we mentioned this before, but expressing that concept to most people just seems like such a foreign concept, and it's so strange. Why would you think of a river as a living being? But this is an idea that's been around far longer than so-called rights under Western liberal democracy frameworks. Mm-hmm. These are actually the perspectives of indigenous peoples the world over. And I also think that what I saw in the film, you're just really taking this indigenous perspective and implementing and incorporating it into the legal framework and granting rights to these things that we may not, in our way of thinking, traditionally understand to be alive, like a river, like a lake, or the atmosphere, the oceans, or whatever it may be. How did each of you come across this rights of nature movement? And if you could talk about, once you were both introduced to this idea, what have you come to understand it to be? I could ask Josh first, if you could answer that, and we can go from there.
Mine goes back to basically like an existential crisis in college, dealing with watching a documentary like The Corporation, which I think was released in 2005. And then reading books like, Story of Bee or Ishmael, you know, where they're talking about what's the next big vision of society, you know, what's going to take us out of this agricultural system into a new system. I remember just grappling with those concepts in school and being really unfulfilled when trying to have conversations about it in the classroom. And then going back and thinking about human rights as this next wave of thinking that revolutionized our society. And then, you know, I'm trying to like process that, like what's going to be the wave after human rights, and what seemed to happen for me organically, and then also happening in the real world in Pennsylvania, was that it was clear that rights of nature could be the next evolution of our society when it came to confronting agriculture and confronting colonialism and everything else that we have. So I really came to it, you know, through this, you know, experience in school, just trying to understand what to do, you know, in the future with our work. And I wrote a business plan for a company in Ohio that was based on these rights of nature principles, where we were overthrowing the food system there and creating a local food system that was implementing, you know, kind of rights of nature ideas. And that was like 2007 and 2008 that we were rolling that out. And, you know, I gave some speeches about rights of nature in Bowling Green State University around like 2010 or 11. And you may as well have been talking about aliens. People were just looking at you like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm like, well, I think we could give nature rights. That's what I'm talking about. And professors are like, what the fuck is he saying? You know, and they're like, and it was hard to talk about it back then. You had very little to stand on. And, you know, so when Melissa and I got confronted with rights of nature being a part of the resistance for the fracking movement, we were like, holy shit, like we can finally talk about this concept and people will be willing to, like, you know, have a discussion about it. And back to your thoughts about capitalism, you know, and Milton Friedman and indigenous cultures and Western cultures, I think that Western cultures may never have reached a point of rights of nature without capitalism. For me, capitalism is like this thing that's created a defense mechanism unknowingly. It's the Achilles heel of capitalism, which is rights of nature. So I feel like, you know, that's kind of an evolution beyond capitalism that will replace it someday, unless we just move straight into fascism. So, yeah.
And Melissa, how about you?
Well, I think I've, you know, like Josh, I've always had this background, sore discomfort over the way things are, and never quite been satisfied with the solutions or answers that I've come across. And that carried through after I became an environmental journalist and started covering water contamination. So I guess more recently I came to Rights of Nature through water, in documenting the water contamination from the fracking development across Pennsylvania, where I'm from, and the systemic cover-up of that harm by both states and corporations. And like Josh said, after the screenings of our first film, Triple Divide, which was a documentary about that cover-up, that systemic collusion to cover up the water contamination and poisoning of people, people we know who've died, and many, many more. At the end of those screenings, people, you know, well, if the system's so fucked, then what do we do? And for a while, there was a lot of discussion about removing personhood from corporations, and I'm not opposed to that, but I do also acknowledge that removing corporate personhood does not stop corporate harm. And then one day I heard about this community, Grant Township in Western Pennsylvania, who had passed a local law asserting their community rights to establish rights for nature. And it was that mechanism through that mechanism that they banned the injection of radioactive waste in their community. This is a very rural, predominantly, if not all white, Republican municipality in Pennsylvania. And they democratically voted to become a home rule municipality, pass a local bill of rights, and then a home rule charter to ban this activity. And when I heard about that, and then I found out, oh, there's this whole movement, the Rights of Nature movement, to establish legal rights for nature. Those rights being that the living entity that nature is has the right to exist, flourish, and naturally evolve. And, you know, alarm bells. That's when the alarm bells went off in my head. And that, I mean, that is really what I had been waiting for, you know, for a long time. Okay, that is something that makes sense to me, that doesn't feel like I'm playing a game of whack-a-mole. You know what I mean? It could, because it gets to the fundamental problem, which is that in the Western system of law, nature is not a living thing. Nature is property. And private property, which nature is in our law, is the pillar of capitalism. So this one strategy gets to the very core of the problem, it seems to me. And so obviously we needed to make a film about it.
Yeah. Well, you put a lot of love into this, I can tell. And it's something you said about this community in Pennsylvania that was working to stop this injection site. Is mm-hmm. that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, deep well injection site.
Well injection, yeah. Yeah, could you explain what that is, what an injection well site is?
An injection well is where toxic waste is injected underground for disposal. And there are many problems with this, ranging from size. It induces seismic events, earthquakes. It migrates from the so-called storage area it's being injected to, which is really just a geologic formation. It's not like they're like digging down, making a big steel tank, and then injecting into it. They're just injecting into deep formations under the engineered assumption that it's going to stay put because nothing underground ever moves. Right.
Yeah.
So, but obviously, I mean, it does move. It migrates, and it, you know, in Grant Township, where injection was banned through their local charter that granted rights to nature and established their community and didn't establish their community rights, enforced their community rights for consent. Community rights goes hand in hand with rights of nature, and it's really about consent. But they're very rural. Their water, they only get their water from groundwater. They're too far away from any public water system to hook up should an injection well contaminate their aquifer. And they also are very proud of the land, and they love the land where they live. They're very cognizant of the quality of the waters that feed the land and the unique species that live there, only there, in a lot, like the hellbender. The hellbender salamander, which is a prehistoric creature that finds very few places to live because it needs exceptionally pristine and very cold water. And when the company came to their community to put in this waste injection well, they at first tried to bargain. They went up the hierarchy of the ladder of power, so to speak, to their state and federal regulatory agencies, and thought, for sure, once they see how terrible this is for our home and the homes of the creatures who live here, they will deny it. Of course, they did not. And through that process, that process of waking up to the reality that the system of law, that our environmental protection agencies are not actually there to protect us. They are there to permit harm and legalize that harm. They said, okay, well, then we're just going to say no. And that's what they did.
Well, I think you said this, Melissa. This is a white Republican, fairly conservative town. And you don't think of these places, of these people that fit in that demographic of being or having an environmentally sound battle to protect the local environment. And I think that actually points to something really important, fundamentally true, which is that regardless of political affiliation, is that your actual immediate environment is being affected. It doesn't seem like it matters whether you're a supposedly Trump or Biden supporter or conservative or liberal. It seems like it cuts through all of those dichotomies, those polarizations that we seem to experience in the United States right now. It seems to cut through that. Ones that affects you and your family and your area. Josh, in your experience of filming this, does that come up? Political affiliation and recognizing that actually that the system itself is actually meant to benefit corporations in that process. And for people that are politically aligned on the right, I mean, how do they deal with that when that issue comes up for them?
Yeah, I definitely want to jump on that. I got to remember, though, speaking of our whiteness, I forgot to do the land recognition about where I'm at. I'm in so-called, occupied Pittsburgh here, which used to be the land of the Osage, Susquehanna, and the Haudenosaunee. And in this place, it's now occupied, as you said, by a lot of right-wing white people, and many of them were in Grant Township, and they did vote for a bill that has rights of nature included in it. And yes, that completely destroys most of your beliefs if you're listening to this right now, because this shit just doesn't sound real. And that boils down to, the framing of these issues, and who's doing the framing. The discussion about the right to clean water works in rural areas because most of them in Pennsylvania, unlike many other parts in the country, are on their own water supplies. So they understand what it means to have clean water, free water, and to have that water be jeopardized. So for anybody to come in and threaten that availability of clean water to them, they will fight that, and they have fought that. And many of them are our sources at Public Herald, and they've influenced our work to date, and we wouldn't have done any of the work we've done to date without many of the conservative Republicans sharing their stories with us about their concerns for the environment. This common mistake of excluding the conservative community from the environmental discussions is something people have to reflect on and remember pretty often, because it's not true. There is an opportunity to talk with the conservative community about the environment, but it sure as hell isn't going to be an opportunity in regards to regulation. So don't be going in there trying to talk to them about increasing regulations, because they're going to turn their back on you and shut the door. And I don't blame them. Maybe I would have said that was okay to talk about regulations in college because I was being somewhat brainwashed by classes. But immediately after I got out, it became really clear that these regulatory agencies are total failures. The most important laws in the country were passed by a conservative president. Richard Nixon is responsible for all of our environmental laws that mean anything to date. And even with that, we're still polluting rivers and creeks and everything else so bad that here in the city of Pittsburgh, I can't walk out my door and take my dog to a creek or a river without being worried about her being poisoned by pollution somewhere, which is fucking crazy. You know, there's creeks and rivers all over this city, and I can't go to one without worrying about pollution. And that is a result of our regulatory systems. And I think the conservative communities understand that. I mean, they're not fucking blind. They're seeing what's going on. And why would they have any faith in it? Fracking has just destroyed that public trust to the point where it's never going to be recovered, ever. You're going to have an entirely new system of dealing with environmental safety. And that's what Grand Township is doing. They're doing that new system, which is that, listen, the state is totally fucking us. They want to pump poisons into our ground underneath our feet and potentially ruin our water supply. So we're going to make our own decisions. And many of the communities in the country have the opportunity to do that. They have a system set in place called Home Rule, which they can utilize. And if they pass Home Rule legislation, like Grant did, they can start to take away the state's responsibilities for their community. And then they become the decision makers of that community, which is what Grant did. And I don't know any right-wing community in the country who wouldn't say they want less of the state and federal government in their backyards. So I think that's what it boils down to, with why a place like this would welcome such a radically driven environmental concept.
Yeah. Well, that's something that came up in the film with one of the, I can't remember their name, working for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, explaining to these people in the community that the EPA, as a regulatory agency, does not prevent environmental pollution and disruption. They just put their stamp of approval on it. I mean, could you talk about that? I'll point this to Melissa, but what are some of the biggest misconceptions people have about the EPA regulatory agencies and their actual role in so-called protecting and regulating pollution and all the things that are affecting local environments?
You should buffer that with your experience, Melissa. Folks, okay. Melissa is one of the few journalists in the country has the largest online database of state records available to the public. So we speak on this issue about, regulators as experts of what they're doing, for sure.
And I still work in the world of regulatory policy change. I'll start there. Thank you, Josh. So I work on regulations and environmental policy, specifically with regard to oil and gas waste. And though I talk shit on the regulatory regime all the time, I do acknowledge that due to the moment we're in and the decades of harm that's already been done, we need a system, a regulatory system that manages the waste streams from the industrial revolution and from the modern fracking era and from the we need it to manage the mining industry that is ramping up in order to feed the renewable the renewable energy revolution, right? I mean, there are certain places where regulations must persist, and with regard to toxic and radioactive waste, that's one of them. The reality is that we have a lot of wonderful words on paper in terms of regulation and environmental policy. But there's also a lot of loopholes. For example, the oil and gas industry does not have to comply with major portions of hazardous waste law and safe drinking water law, which affords them the opportunity, the privilege to inject poisons underground that no one else is allowed to do. Because if you and I did what they do, we would go to jail. So there's special exemptions. There are also the regulatory agencies are filled with scientists and engineers, and that makes people feel good. Unfortunately, the regulatory agencies are at the whim and under the control of the politics of the day. I mean, Trump's EPA is different from Obama's EPA, which is different from the original EPA, right? And so, but I don't want to hit too hard on the idea that the regulatory system isn't working properly. There are pieces of it that I think are necessary. There are pieces that are not allowed to work or that are not working as they should. But also the regulatory system is actually working the way that it should, is supposed to. And when I say that, I mean regulators regulate harm. They take what is seen as a societal necessity, which is resource extraction and manufacturing, which create pollution and harm, and they regulate the amount of that that can happen in given places. The problem is that there is not a fundamental understanding of the laws of nature. There's not a fundamental recognition of the laws of nature underpinning that regulatory system. And so decisions made like, okay, well, we can discharge 400 tons of formaldehyde into the air from this one facility, in this one region, say Pittsburgh, a year. There's all kinds of problems with that. I kind of want to walk that back a bit, but I think the point is regulatory agencies, environmental protection agencies, are actually regulating harm. And there is an assumption that that harm is necessary. And that necessity is not born of a place that recognizes and understands ecology and the laws of nature and the web of life. Just there's a fundamental disconnect there that our indigenous brothers and sisters did not have. I mean, they were and are connected, and our society, our modern society, is not. And so by virtue of that fundamental disconnect, everything's off kilter and nothing actually protects the natural world.
Yeah, I think indigenous communities, indigenous peoples, indigenous communities are always on the front line of these mm-hmm. things, always. You document some of that in your film. Same thing with the Seneca tribe in Pennsylvania, and they were also at the forefront yeah. of fighting environmental destruction in their community as well. So I think it's really important that we just acknowledge this is a way of thinking and a way of living and being that is indigenous, and whether we're descendants of settlers or not, or we are settlers ourselves, I think we can do what we can to align ourselves with that perspective as much as possible. And it benefits mm-hmm. everybody and every living thing to do that. I think it's really important.
Absolutely. And wouldn't it be amazing if all land was returned to the indigenous the original inhabitants of this land. I mean, we wouldn't need a rights of nature movement then.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, right.
we wouldn't need it. But, and as much as I wish that that could happen tomorrow, I think that in the meantime, because I really do, like, I pray that that will be a real thing in my lifetime, for sure. In the meantime, the community rights and rights of nature strategy is a mechanism that can be used to practice that stewardship in the places that we call home.
Yeah, there's a good test for that too. You know, much of the indigenous culture has a belief system and a framework that is very ecocentric. So nature has the voice when they're speaking about specific things, rather than pretty much everything in our culture, which is anthropocentric. It's a human-centered thing. And I think that's a really good test. You know, if you want to, you know, weigh the options of an idea and whether or not it works with rights of nature, with the laws of nature, you have to ask yourself, you know, is this an anthropocentric idea or an ecocentric idea, you know, as a part of our culture? I think, you know, for me, I feel very strongly about eliminating much of the anthropocentric work that we've created and rebuilding it through something that's ecocentric. And that involves like wiping out 99% of what we have.
Yeah.
It's yeah. Like, 'cause when you ask that question, it's just that everything we have is so fucking human centered. It's nauseating. You know, it's nauseating to think about that we've put ourselves at the center so much of all these things and have eliminated all of these amazing parts of nature from being at the center.
Excluded it. Yeah.
Excluded it of those places. It's just like astounding. And when Melissa and I tried to talk with the indigenous communities about rights of nature back in, 2014, we were touring Triple Divide. We talked to the Ho-Chunk and the Blackfeet, and they were like, you know, what are you talking about, rights of nature? And we're like, fuck. We thought this would be like part of their system, but we're fucking idiots. Like, of course, everything in their system is there for rights of nature, and it's sacred.
They don't need rights of nature.
And it's relative, you know, and it's just they have an ancestral relationship with nature, and that language is already there. So rights of nature is just this, of course, this foreign white word that identifies those things, you know, essentially in our culture. It's our way of digesting that stuff because our minds are programmed, you know, differently.
Yeah, it's our way of putting nature back in the fucking equation that where it doesn't exist. But in indigenous culture, it wasn't removed in the first place.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And one thing I think that it is important to note is that human-centered law excludes nature by subjugating it to property. Doesn't exclude it, but subjugates it. But ecocentric law does not subjugate anything. It's inclusive of humanity and all people equally as a living, breathing member of the web of life. And by centering the laws of nature and the sacredness of nature within our decision-making processes, it changes everything. It really does. And again, though I wish we weren't in this position to work within Western law to do what needs to be done, the reality is that we are. And if we can manage to flip the script and put nature inside of that system of law where she belongs, then it makes corporations, the power they have over the political system, impotent, because the decisions are not made by corporations and big government anymore. Decisions get made inside of communities. Communities are the decision makers. They hold the power under a rights of nature framework.
Yeah. Well, let's play out a scenario here based on all the various communities that you document in this film, all their stories. Based on that, if there's a community in the U.S. and there's some environmentally destructive practices, some corporation wants to dump pollutants into a river, watershed, waste into a well, all the ways in which corporations want to get away with murder, basically. What are some practical ways that communities can begin to take the steps to protect their local environments? Yeah.
We actually have, we have a webpage, an action page at invisiblehandfilm.com that lists a lot of the resources, the groups working on this movement. And I think the first step is to reach out to people doing the work already and have conversations with them. It's important to really understand that this is a fight. It isn't always a fight. Sometimes enacting a local law granting rights to nature is easy because everybody's on board. And there isn't a corporation standing outside your door or breathing down the back of your neck to do something terrible. So in a preemptive case, it could be easy. But for a lot of people, it's not. It's very difficult. For example, the state of Ohio has passed legislation banning rights of nature initiatives. The state of Missouri, legislators in the state of Missouri are about to do the same thing and ban rights of nature cases from appearing in court. The American Petroleum Institute has now gotten involved in a federal case involving rights of nature. So it's a good time to get involved in the rights of nature movement because there's so much happening. The flip side of that is now that there's a lot happening, big government and the corporate community is starting to get really freaked the fuck out. And so it's important to know that you could be up for the fight of a lifetime. So reach out to the people already in that fight and start talking to them. Also, reach out to the people in your own community and drill down. No, that's a terrible word. I stop saying that. Have a conversation about the core values in your community, because in the midst of a really hard fight, you gotta have that place to keep coming back to. Everyone in this community relies on clean drinking water, and everyone in this community depends on each other and the non-humans in this ecosystem to survive. So get real clear with the community on core values even before you get into the nitty-gritty of the specific fight that you're taking on. I think it's really good to have that bedrock of common ground. And so it's a bit of an awareness education effort. But if a community is already there, you can reach out to an organization like the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which is one of the organizations who walks a community through and stands at their side to establish local laws. They have attorneys, they have experience, they have community advocates who will, answer the phone anytime when you're feeling like, oh my God, this effing sucks. We've gotten to know the CELDEF organizers really well over the years, and they are very beautiful, passionate, and skilled people. And they love, they work very closely and form really strong bonds in the communities where they work. So, yeah. And also another thing you can do, getting back to the awareness and education thing, is to share the film. Have a community screening of Invisible Hand. I mean, if you can't, it's actually a really great way to get everybody in a room and see and watch people walk through that, the process to establish local laws to defend themselves and nature. You know, the film does it, like you said earlier, this film spans 6 years and you get to see that process take place and all the ups and downs that come with it. And the successes, the setbacks. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, I can see that people can watch the film right now if they'd like. They can do screenings. But what is the best way people can watch this film right now? What's the next steps in releasing this film over the next several months or the year? Where are you in that process right now?
Yeah, well, the best way to do it and to support the work we do is just to join our Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/publicherald. And there you can just pay a dollar if you want and become, you know, a dollar supporter every month. And you'll get a free link to watch the Invisible Hand and to watch the other documentaries we have. And we hope that you, you know, stay and support us. But that's one of the easiest ways to do it. Or you can go directly to invisiblehandfilm.com. And on that page, there's the two screening options, which is if you want to watch it at home, you can either rent it through Vimeo, so it's a streaming service, or you can join our Patreon and get the link and watch it that way. And if you want to screen the film with, you know, the virtual event with your community, we've had a lot of success with those so far. We're going to start doing virtual events again in 2021. And you can do that by filling out the form on our screenings page. So it's just invisiblehandfilm.com/screenings. And we'll help, you know, walk you through that process. And we have a screening page already set up for people. So it's kind of a full, you know, safe, setup. You don't have to worry about anything. And, yeah, that's the best way to do it.
All right. Great. I don't have any more questions. I think both of you laid it out. The spirit of the film, the focus, you did that incredibly well. I'll be putting all the resources, everything you mentioned, including the film and all that, I'll be putting that in the description of this episode. So thank you both so much for your time and for doing this. I really, really appreciate your work. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Patrick. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you, Patrick. You know, wish all the success for your show. Thanks for having us on.